The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher, go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power, and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. Hello and welcome to the Americano show. Today we're going to be talking about Keir Starmer's visit to Washington, which happened last night, if we're on UK time, which we are here in London. I am joined by Kate Andrews, who is our US deputy editor, and by The Telegraph's Tim Stanley to discuss. Tim, I'll start with you. Labour, the government, seemed pretty pleased with how things went. They got what they wanted. How right are they to be chuffed?
They should be pleased. I think we can credit some of this to Starmer's style, but none of it is a surprise. I want to begin by commending your performance on Question Time, Freddie. It's an example of the kind of commentary we need on Trump versus the kind of commentary that we get. If you watch that programme, you had one liberal commentator claiming that when Trump says jump, Starmer says higher. And as you rightly said, all Britain has done is raise its defense spending to 2.5%. And there was another commentator on the panel who said that he predicts that in the future, Donald Trump, Xi Jinping, and Vladimir Putin will form an axis that will divide up the world between them. Trump's election has been met by hysteria by the UK commentariat, which is irresponsible, because it terrifies viewers and the electorate. But it also hinges on this extraordinary amnesia. We've been dealing with Donald Trump now for 10 years. We know how he works. We know that his strategy is to begin any negotiation by making the wildest demands and throwing out the most libelous claims, such as Zelensky was a dictator. But we know he also has in the back of his mind a reasonable outcome. So Britain went to America ostensibly to save the West. Watching TV, this really was how it was being presented to me by Sky News, who covered the whole event like a wrestling match. Here's what Trump will have to do. Here's what Starmer will have to do. Here's what Trump will do. But what does a win look like? All this rubbish. But you and I know, for having covered Trump for 10 years now, he's always perfectly charming. And he usually says yes to the last person he met. So Starmer sits down with Trump. Starmer pulls out the invitation to the palace, which had a sort of Jim'll fix it vibe about it. it was sweet, but kind of weird and creepy at the same time. Trump went along with it. I'll check the signature on the letter. Very funny. So Britain opens the doors, which is what Trump wants to Buckingham Palace. He wants to be treated with respect. But otherwise, it then becomes this list of here's what Britain thinks, and Trump going, yeah, sure. Okay. Some of which, by the way, he may well then review. Are we certain that America is on board with the Chagos deal? We're not entirely certain. But equally, am I really surprised that America is not too concerned about precisely who controls the Diego Garcia Islands? And when he was asked about the future of AUKUS, the president replied, what is that? You know, so what I watched was, I think, a domestic win for Keir Starmer, because the big thing that came out of it was Trump saying to Starmer, he's a great negotiator, a really tough one, which is just pure charm. But it'll go down very well in the UK because the left will be able to say, thank goodness we've got a prime minister who can stand up to Trump. So it was a domestic win for Starmer. But I think if you put it in the broader context of what America's trying to do, does it really matter? Does it really make much difference? I don't know. Because negotiations over the future of Ukraine have only just started. We don't quite know where all of this ends. But I proceed, whenever I talk about Trump, I proceed on the assumption that he's a rational actor. He knows what he wants. He's just getting it by unconventional means. And my goodness, I wish the commentariat would remember that.
Kate, what do you think of Tim's rather wonderful analysis there? I think I agree with a lot of what he says. And I've always been struck, ever since I've looked at meetings between prime ministers and presidents of the United States, I'm always struck at how needy the British side are. We always seem to get overexcited at the slightest bit of praise, far too defensive at anything that might go wrong. We come across hysterical, and I think it's probably because of a sort of unconscious realization that we really don't matter that much anymore.
Well, it's a hostile neediness, isn't it? Because as you say, Freddie, there's this desperation to get along, this insistence that it all has to go perfectly, otherwise it's a catastrophe. Everybody has to be on equal footing, everybody has to smile, otherwise the special relationship is fundamentally breaking down. But at the same time, you can't be too kind to the president. You can't be too supportive to the president. You have to push back on the president. And I think it does speak to your point, Freddie, that there is a sense of almost trying to prove oneself, but then also desperately wanting approval. Mm. And Starmer, to credit him, did walk that line on this visit. And I think Tim is completely right to say that it will be not just a success. I mean, these are going to be some of the best front pages that Keir Starmer has had since he became prime minister. It's going to be a big win for him here in the UK. But I agree, you do just get that slight sense of, oh gosh, like this matters completely. And then in the US, don't get me wrong, Americans adore the UK. And they're much more likely to know who the prime minister is than a leader from any other country. But it's not going to carry the same weight for very obvious reasons. And so it doesn't cost Donald Trump very much, actually, to be nice. It doesn't cost him too much to be charming, because Starmer hasn't asked him for very much that he has fully clocked. I think on the Chagos deal, as Donald Trump said, he said, oh, I'm kind of interested. Maybe this will go ahead. Of course, Donald Trump is very much in the market right now for ideas that involve buying other countries. So you could see why he might initially warm to it when he looks into those details. Do we think the China element might change his mind? I think it very well could. But the only thing that Keir Starmer really asked Donald Trump for was a security guarantee for Ukraine, something that is expected to be signed by President Zelensky with this rare earths deal, which is supposed to involve a security guarantee. So he asked him for something that he already knew was written down on paper and very likely to be signed by the Ukrainian president. He didn't ask for very much at all. I think that the huge question here, and Freddie, you hint at it, is what would happen if Donald Trump were to fail to secure a peace deal? If he were to pull funding from Ukraine and Europe actually had to grapple with the cost of funding the war, with potential troops, with all of the weaponry and machinery that would be needed, Europe doesn't have this. It doesn't have the cash, doesn't have the resources. What on earth would it do? And that's when you might actually see a slightly less charming and much more serious conversation between the two leaders, and I doubt it would go as well.
Before we dwell on those more serious points, can we just talk quickly about Keir Starmer's voice? Because I'm very interested that Donald Trump, I think sincerely, thinks Keir Starmer has a very fine and beautiful voice. Because not only did he say it in the press conference, we then had an exclusive interview. Ben Dominich, our editor at large in America, had an exclusive interview, sit down 1 hour with the president, and Trump said it again. He doubled down on what a beautiful voice he thinks Keir Starmer has. Tim, am I missing something in Keir Starmer's voice in thinking that I don't think British people think it's beautiful. I think they find it quite grating.
Well, I think Trump is right, and I am flattered by association, because Keir is from my part of the world. Keir and I both grew up in the slum ghetto of West Kent and East Sussex, where everyone speaks like Keir and me. It's a sort of a flat accent, but it enunciates quite well. And I can understand why foreigners like it, because it's very clear. So I suspect he was responding to that. So I constantly do impressions, bad ones of people. It's very important that we work together and all that sort of stuff. But I'm mocking myself, because actually whenever Keir speaks, and I know to some people it's like fingers down a blackboard, but whenever I hear him, I think that's probably how I sound too.
That's, well, I disagree, Tim. I think you obviously go nasal when you're doing your Starmer impression. And it's the nasal element that I can't bear.
But by the way, to come back to the way Trump always behaves, he latches onto aesthetics, which is a very old man, old world thing to do. Like, he can't help himself. If this guy had sat down with Indira Gandhi, he'd say, she's a very beautiful woman. And it's the same with Keir Starmer. He's looking for something positive to say about his personality. And of course, you can't say Keir Starmer is handsome or thin. So you go with, you've got a nice voice, dear.
Yeah, yeah. And a suit. And he praised his suit, too.
Americans are nasally, right? We speak up here, and my voice is not a perfect American accent anymore because it's been heavily changed by my time in the UK. But we're more comfortable with people who are kind of up here.
Yeah.
And I think that Stama's voice will have maybe appealed to some of that. Also, if you're not terribly familiar with the range of British accents, you can see a world where that was considered to be the most beautiful British accent.
Is it not worth remembering to both of you that Theresa May, when she came to Washington the first time in 2017, the reception in the press the next day was rather similar to what we see today in the papers about Keir Starmer. It's, special relationship still looking good. You know, government got what they wanted. Theresa May's team are happy, etc. And then, you know, fast forward to that famous interview press conference at Chequers. Donald Trump gave an insane interview just before that one to The Sun, in which he said lots of things that blew things up. So what I'm saying is that we should not overread one fairly friendly encounter, because certainly Donald Trump and the American press aren't.
Yeah. And crucially, where is the trade deal? We still haven't got the trade deal, even though we were supposedly intellectually on the same plane as America, thanks to Brexit. And this brings us back to Kate's very good point, that to what extent does Britain matter, and what is Britain really trying to get out of this? So what Trump has said in the last few weeks is, if Europe wants Ukraine to be independent, it's going to have to pay for it. So what we ought to be doing right now is talking about mobilizing Europe to build our own independent military. Instead, what Starmer really is doing is going to America to check that America is still on board. Right? Whatever the political context, whether it's Wilson, Macmillan, Thatcher, whatever, for Britain, the principal question is still, can I persuade America to be on our side in changing circumstances? So I, in the same way that May is going there to say, you know, we've just got frozen out of Europe, we feel alone right now, we'd like to be reassured that America's on our side, Britain is saying, we feel frozen out by America right now, we want to make sure you're still on our side. So in that sense, I agree strongly that I think Britain is still fundamentally playing a weak hand.
Kate, in the interview with Ben Dobnich, which we must keep plugging because it's a big get for The Spectator.
Donald Trump's first magazine interview in his second term.
Yes. Trump did talk about the British Navy, and he said he thinks the European Navy's terrible. The Brits are sort of slightly better, but they need our help. Mm-hmm. So it does seem as though Starmer's effort, Labour's efforts to really push Britain as the one that is the better NATO friend than Europe, they have sunk into the president's brain at any rate.
They have, and I would argue for pretty good reason. I think Keir Starmer has been one of the more friendly leaders to Donald Trump. The fact that he went and had dinner with him in New York before he was reelected, when it was not clear which way that election was going to go last November, in retrospect, very easy to see, but before maybe not so much. I think that the prime minister's decision to do that really opened a door. You know, it was a very friendly gesture, and Donald Trump responds very well to friendly gestures. And he doesn't care what you said about him in the past. David Lammy was there. He had previously called him a neo-Nazi, and it did not seem to matter as they were having their dinner, because it was a very friendly extension. And to Tim's excellent point, the last person Trump was in a room with, he may well lambast, but he also might be incredibly gracious about. So the fact that Ben was sitting down with the president hours after Starmer had left the White House meant that the UK was on his mind. But Trump did not have to be generous. And you're right, in this interview with Ben, he decided to be quite generous, noting that he thought the UK's defenses were probably stronger than the rest of Europe's. I think the very painful reality is that isn't saying much at this point. And I think Trump has two very good points to make when it comes to these negotiations between the UK and the US specifically. The first is, actually, the first one's broader in terms of Europe, but why should America keep paying for Europe to funnel all of its taxpayer money into benefits, into subsidized healthcare, into very, very expensive social projects, while they're not having to build up their defense, because the assumption is America will do it? I think it's a compelling point. And I think another compelling point made by the Americans and Donald Trump is that, you know, free trade deals work when both parties feel like they're benefiting. And the attitude towards American produce and American agriculture, for no very good reason, is just utterly nasty across the UK and Europe. I mean, you'll struggle to find Tories who will say that you should import chicken from America, and for really questionable science around that, around chlorinated chicken. You know, they hate the idea of American food and American produce, and I think there's a very good question to be asked, you know, why? And if Europe, and specifically the UK, to get a free trade deal, are not going to be open to that, then of course it's going to be difficult. I would say near impossible to secure a free trade deal. And I think it's quite telling that neither leader really drew too much emphasis to that, because I think they both know in their heart of hearts that it's going to be near impossible to secure.
You do say that about chlorinated chicken, you're right. But I mean, America now has an administration and Robert F. Kennedy mm-hmm. Jr. in charge of health, who take a very negative view about American foodstuffs mm-hmm. And do often point out, RFK Jr. often points out that, you know, these things are banned in Europe. These substances that we put in our food are banned in Europe. So perhaps the European concern about American food is not quite as crazy as
I don't think. Well, first of all, I think it depends very much on what we're comparing. I mean, the chemicals that are poured into processed food is kind of different from the way that, you know, free-range chicken is preserved and transported. Look, I'm, as somebody who fundamentally believes that more choices is better, I think that, you know, Americans having the opportunity to buy different products and often cheaper products is not fundamentally a bad thing. Personally, whilst I think RFK has done a fantastic job in highlighting how unhealthy America is, and it's disproportionate, especially among children, it's a serious problem. I'm not convinced that all of his solutions, including his stance on vaccines, are the right one. So there's a debate to be had there. But I've never seen a serious debate like that happen in the UK or indeed in Europe,
it's
right?
It's always about the chicken and
it's
the
always
beef.
About the chicken. So, you know,
sometimes a bit of beef.
Maybe a bit of beef. But again, they're just really upset that it's cheaper. And so, you know, if we were to engage in the seriousness of certain chemicals being put into foods, fantastic. I haven't really seen any political leader do that.
Tim, Emmanuel Macron's visit this week was probably not the biggest visit this week. Keir Starmer's visit this week to Washington was probably not the biggest visit. It's probably going to be today, with Vladimir Zelensky coming over to sign a first agreement about the minerals. How significant do you think it is? What's your reading of it, given that 7 days ago Trump was calling Zelensky a dictator and so on? We have just gone through this entire whirlwind, it seems, in order to reach this point.
Let's wait and see. First of all, I thought you were going to say the most significant visit was going to be the Tate brothers. and I'm only slightly joking, because I did find it very funny when watching Sky News' coverage that they had in the corner a little camera shot of the Tate brothers arriving in Florida exactly as Keir Starmer arrived at the White House. So they were of equal weight. And it's an example of how the media will chastise and criticize Donald Trump for being superficial. And the media then reports that superficiality and wallows in it, right?
Yes.
And projects it. But in the case of Zelensky, we are led to believe that Trump has pulled the rug out from underneath the Ukrainian war effort. The reality is that the war had reached a stalemate. There was going to be some kind of negotiation, whoever had won the election. And as regards to this particular deal, the Ukrainians are keen to remind us that they suggested it first. They probably did not imagine their country was going to be turned into an economic colony. Don't get me wrong. I think there's something fundamentally amoral about that. But what Trump is trying to get out of them is a pay for play, whereby, look, if you, and it makes sense, if America does not want to simply be out of the kindness of its heart guaranteeing the sovereignty and security of Ukraine, then at least allow it to invest in Ukraine such that the backstop is that if Russia attempts to attack this country again, it is messing with American economic interests. And therefore, America will presumably defend it on a rational basis rather than an idealistic one. So that makes sense. But let's actually see the detail and what they come up with. Because, yeah, a key thing yesterday was the president saying the talks are going on. And he said it's a very strange formula. He said we'll either have a peace very quickly or not at all. And of course, that's him piling pressure on Zelensky and on Putin. He's saying this is your one shot for peace. And one final point, again, this whole strategy of apparently suddenly flipping on your allies and forcing everyone to make peace is not only unusual, it's only a norm for Trump. It's not unheard of in American history, too. Isn't this what happened in Afghanistan with Biden, who just suddenly withdrew, having negotiated with the enemy he'd been, America had been fighting, the Taliban? Isn't this what happened in 1975, when America, having persuaded the South Vietnamese to build up their military and defend themselves against the North, Congress suddenly cut funding, and Gerald Ford announced that the Vietnam War was over and the South Vietnamese were invaded and conquered by the communist North? I'm sad to say that what we're seeing play out is something America has done many times before, which is to encourage someone to fight, supposedly in defense of some existential question of the future of democracy, only at the last minute for America to decide it spent too much money and it would like to leave.
That's a fascinating point, Tim, and I wonder what you make of that, Kate, as an American.
Well, no, I think it's a point very well made. I don't think it simply points to the U.S., though. I think actually can make the accusation even more strongly across Europe that there has been, and you know, Freddie, we've spoken about this quite a bit, that there has been a relentless push on the part of Europe to tell Ukraine to keep fighting. And yet Europe is never going to do the heavy lifting when it comes to that fighting, certainly not in terms of money or weapons as discussed, but most importantly, not in terms of body count. You know, it's not German soldiers, it's not British soldiers who have yet put their boots on the ground. And the immediate response from Ukraine, from the people, to willingly and actively defend themselves was one of the most remarkable things, you know, we may ever witness in our lifetime. It was incredibly courageous. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, would you do the same thing? I think many people would not. And the Ukrainians, they have been fighting for their sovereignty and freedom. But on multiple occasions where perhaps there was a more ideal opportunity and moment to start talking about some kind of negotiation, Europe in particular, and the Biden administration, you know, they just kept pushing as if there weren't trade-offs to the fact that people continue to fight and to die every day. So I think you can point the finger at America and Europe on this point. Donald Trump is being more honest and realistic in many ways when it comes to what has to happen in order to get peace. And that includes not using language that would immediately stop Russia from coming to the table, which is, I think, roughly kind of what we saw at the UN. Of course, on the other hand, he is misleading and deceitful in many ways with his language, as we discussed around Zelensky as a dictator. You kind of get both extremes with Donald Trump. You get radical honesty and radical deceit. And I think it's, you know, our job as journalists to try to sift between the two and get somewhere closer to what might actually be happening.
Tim, do you think that Donald Trump gives European leaders the off-ramp they need, in a way, on the Ukraine conflict? Because Trump will make the compromises that they would have had to make anyway at some stage, and they can just blame it on him because he's so odious and crazy, etc.
Yeah, that may well be true. I would add to that that, of course, European opinion is shifting as well. We have seen in Germany a party coming in second place with a historic vote, a party which is determined to restore the Third Reich and to prove that it is led by a lesbian with a Sri Lankan partner. And that party is critical of the war. This has been the case across the continent. Small but significant minorities of voters are voting for parties which are critical of the war. And that won't just be because they don't think it's going well or because they have fallen for very often outright lies about the war told on social media, but it'll also be because of the economic cost of it. We have paid a price. We've paid a price in cheap gas exports being switched off, and that has been felt by a whole generation of people. And it's one more reason why the war was likely to be brought to some sort of conclusion. And I suspect that had Biden been elected, that conclusion wouldn't be very much different from what Trump is now trying to negotiate.
Tim and Kate, we'll end it there. But thank you very much for coming on to Americano.
Thank you, Freddie.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening into it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. and speak to you next time.